Hello and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography. Today's episode of Out of the Frame, conversations about photography, was recorded on the lands of the Dja Dja Wurrung country. I'd like to acknowledge traditional owners of the land that we live, work, create and thrive on, the people of the Kulin Nation. I pay respects to their elders past and present. It was and always will be Aboriginal land. My guest today is Kate Robertson. Through experimental analogue and digital photographic techniques, Kate explores unseen yet felt phenomena relating to healing and connectedness with environmental community contexts. She works with cameraless photographic methods and with photographic processes that can act as receptacle for absorbing and understanding imparted information rather than merely a mechanism for capturing a descriptive likeness. By attributing agency to materials and matter, Kate explores notions of perception and feeling in image making. Recent exhibitions include From All Points of the Southern Sky, Photography from Australia and Oceania, Southeast Museum of Photography, 2020. Bakehouse Billboard Takeover for Centre for Contemporary Photography, 2019. Recording the Medicinal Plants of Sawai Bougainville, Jarvis Dooney Gallery, 2018, for European Month of Photography. New Matter, Art Gallery of New South Wales, 2016. The Alchemists, Australian Centre for Photography, 2015. Gan Kinney to Gan Yu, Artists Who Capture the Night, GYRACC, Catherine, 2015. She has exhibited in Australia, Papua New Guinea, America, the United Kingdom, Germany, the Netherlands, China, and New Zealand. In 2018, Kate's work was published in a book titled Kunai Sewai Pokong, which has been accessioned into the Papua New Guinean National Museum and Art Gallery in PNG, Australian Museum in Australia, and Field Museum within the USA. Her work is held in numerous collections, including the Art Gallery of New South Wales, Southeast Museum of Photography and Centre for Creative Photography in USA. She lives on Wadawurrung country in Australia. Welcome, Kate. Thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. I thought I would start by getting you to tell us a little bit about how you got into photography.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on your program, Pia. It's a really interesting question, how I got into photography, because it took me a little while to try and remember, because I realised that I've loved photography since I was pretty young, actually. I was using my dad's Pentax camera quite a bit when we used to go on bushwalks when we lived in northeast Victoria when I was about 12. And I remember entering a competition just at the Bright Society, Photographic Society, just of some landscapes that I did. So I've always had an interest in it, and it was probably when I, in my last 2 years of schooling, my parents moved us across to Auckland in New Zealand, and I went to a much larger school there, and they actually had a dark room. And so I was introduced to the darkroom and the magic of, the magic and the alchemy of the beautiful analog darkroom. And that really cemented my passion for it. And from there, I applied for the RMIT degree in photography straight after that. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. And you got in, obviously.
I got in, yes. I was very amazed because it's quite difficult to get into that program. But yeah, so that's I've kind of been doing it for quite a while.
Yeah, wow. I love that you started out in the bush. I think that's a really beautiful kind of cathartic process, but then also to see that then in the dark room, which is sublime. There is no other, I think, magic like a dark room process. So are the things that you began photographing, is that kind of continuous to what you photograph now, do you think, or are there threads that you can see from those early days to now?
Yeah, I probably hadn't thought about it until we've actually been talking to now. But it is quite interesting that my engagement with photography happened in the environment, because that is still a thread that is in my work. I work in a much more experimental way with photography. So now I don't necessarily use the camera that much. I work with a lot of cameraless techniques. But there's always just a connecting, me trying to connect or find an interconnectedness between me and the things around me, and in particular the environment, the natural environment, and trying to figure out, you know, my place and our, the human place within it, not on top of it or above it, but within it.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. So what are the kind of techniques that you do use that are cameraless, I guess?
Yeah, I work with quite a few different ones. So and I guess it depends on the project that I'm working on as well. So I'm really interested in, you know, thinking about what I'm trying to understand or convey in a project, and thinking about the best aligned process. So previous projects, I've worked with the Lumen process, which is using expired black and white photographic paper in a cameraless method. So you're essentially fogging the paper, exposing it to UV light, which is what we're told not to do. But that's a really beautiful process, because you're giving this paper that doesn't have a purpose anymore because it's expired, so it can't be used. Well, it won't give you a really good print in the dark room.
I see.
You're giving it another life by putting it into the Lumen print process, which is really, really beautiful. And you get these really beautiful pinks and blues and browns.
Yeah, wow.
Once it has a reaction to the material sitting on top of it, and then also the light and the humidity as well. So that's one cameraless process that I use. I also work with scanography. So that's a digital cameraless process. So the flatbed scanner is your capturing device, you would say, and you put objects down on top of that, and then the scan happens over time and space, so you can kind of move things on the glass pane, which is really fun. And then I've been doing some cyanotypes recently as well. And cyanotypes is where you brush on a chemical onto paper or any other substrates that you might like to play around with. So some people will coat up fabric.
Oh, okay. Yep. So it's the same process. Yeah.
Yes. And then expose it and you'll get the deep blues.
Beautiful.
And then I've also just recently I've been testing out anthotypes.
What's anthotypes? I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating process. It's where you work with organic matter. So you can work with leaves. I did one with beetroot. And so what you're using is the actual the photosynthesis in plant material to create the exposure. I grated up some beetroot and squeezed it through a like an old tea towel, and then with that juice I coated paper, and then put I was just testing it with some glass, put some glass on top and then exposed it to UV light over a couple of days. And then that leaves an imprint.
Is the paper the same paper that you use within the lumen process or just a standard paper?
Just a standard paper.
Yeah, wow. Oh, how exciting.
Yes, it's pretty fun.
And I assume then you can use different things like coffee or like whatever different to get different results within that exposure process?
You can, you can. I'm not too sure whether you can do it with coffee.
Or more organic materials.
You could probably. Maybe or more organic materials. I'm still testing it out a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, how great. I think it's what's really nice is that you're also moving across both digital and I guess material processes rather than just analog. Because there is an analog part of scanography. I've used that myself with archival images. But I feel like what's really interesting about all of those kind of cameraless ideas is that, as you say, it's for a particular purpose or a particular context, but they can maybe move inside and outside, which is quite lovely, I think, like that idea of what is your environment? What are the spaces that you're responding to? Are you bringing materials in, you know, into a inside environment with the scanography, or are you taking paper outside, which would traditionally be inside? It's quite a lovely dance, I think, which is quite cool.
Yeah, I like that you've said it's like a dance because it is. It's been responsive to what's around you, and in many ways, it's trying not to force something on the things around us, but. How we move more harmoniously and how photography can do that as well. So, you know, there is a history of photography that is much more violent. And how do we be a little bit more mindful of how we work with photography?
I think that's a really good point, Kate, and I feel like I can now move to talking about your PhD that you completed recently, which was on the micro-community setting in the Siwa region of Bougainville, an autonomous region of Papua New Guinea, specifically looking at traditional medicinal plants as a core value of the Siwa people for cultural preservation. I'd love you to discuss the ethics of working with that community as well as creating a project that really empowered them and I guess the personal connection that you had, but also how artwork and the process of cameraless photography really led to that result of the PhD.
Yes. So I took the ethics of working with a community that was not my own in the beginning quite seriously. And I was very mindful of the extractive nature of photography, particularly in Papua New Guinea, where there is a long history that still continues of photographers going in, extracting and benefiting, whether it's an advancement in their career or a monetary
And benefit. They just kind of fly in, fly out.
Fly in, fly out. And that leaves the community skeptical of outsiders.
Totally. And it makes total sense, right? Like
it does.
Why would you want foreigners then if they're just going to come in, you know, photograph or video your beautiful landscape, take some interviews and then head out again.
And you know, they're in a space where they're going, well, how do we benefit? What do we get from it? That's the ethics of it for me. I took it very, very seriously. And I think it became more so in my PhD because I was actually getting questioned by the university from the ethics committee about how ethical my project was as well. I had a lot of them saying that it wasn't ethical what I was doing. So I had a lot of things around me that was making me feel that, you know, I'm quite a, you know, connected person to the people around me and very sensitive, number one. But two, I'm having these pressures of, you know, what is ethical behavior as a photographer.
I was going to say, but big institutions that, you know, they have this power and you feel like you're working and you've been invited in, you know, like you've actually, it's not like you're just proposing a project, you've actually been invited in by a chief with that trust, with the understanding that you're going to have a sensitivity, you've got a, you know, personal connection to the area, and that you've kind of been tasked this project by a chief. Like, that's no small thing within that community. But then having to, I guess, transcribe that or give that background to an RMIT ethics committee who have no idea of what those kind of, you know, those local embodied experiences are from different community, I could imagine would be really stressful.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what it did was it made me kind of really question what is ethical behaviour. And yeah, I guess some of the things that came out of it was, you know, that consent to be photographed or consent to be working in community context or consent to be photographing the Papua New Guinean environment is not something that's just done prior to the shooting.
Yeah.
Or prior to the making of the work. It has to be something that engages people throughout the process, and it's really, really important to be able to show work at the end.
Yeah, okay.
To see how things have been imaged. The reason why that's important is because consent isn't necessarily a straightforward thing to take. If you go up there and you say, oh, I want to take a photograph of you, I'm going to put it in a gallery, and they say yes, doesn't necessarily mean that they know what a gallery is. There are no galleries up in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, okay.
So
So it's all about that assumed knowledge, isn't it, too?
Exactly. Or, you know, I know that with the RMIT ethics process, I had to put into my my consent form that that the people that I work with, they had to acknowledge that they may have their images on the internet. But I'm working in an area where there are no computers.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of kind of negotiation between two very different societies trying to find out what an ethical way of working is. I think what was really important for this project is that I was working quite closely with a couple of chiefs that regularly went between Western and local community contexts.
So they kind of had one foot in each camp.
They did. So they were the ones that if I did something and they weren't happy with it in terms of, you know, for example, I wanted to photograph a river, and they said you can't photograph that river because it's you know, it's quite a spiritual river, and then beautiful. If you take it out and put it into a gallery context, it's going to lose its significance spirit.
Oh wow! Okay.
So you need to be mindful of those things. So. For me, it was really important just to have those people that knew the context of both worlds. And then it was also important for me just to relinquish control and be okay with that. Like, if it's not meant to be, it's not meant to be.
I think the thing that I find really lovely about that is, by letting go, you're actually being probably more honest to the project, right? Like, there's this authenticity to the moment, to the culture that you're working within, to the divide, which is not easy to negotiate, and you're being respectful to that. But going right back to what you said before about cameraless photography and being mindful, like, it's like your whole project was being mindful then. Like, there is this incredible sense of it's not just me as the auteur, as the photographer, this is actually a community Engage project. This is about the environment, living alongside, not on or taking from. And that's just really beautiful, I think, to be able to go, okay, that wasn't meant to be. You know, what can come is maybe even better or different.
Absolutely. And it's really just the way that I negotiate my art practice from here on in. But it's just one other thing I want to mention about the that way of working. When I came to the PhD and people were saying, well, is it co-authorship or collaboration? That was something that I even had to, you know, sit down and think about. And I ended up saying that these photographic works were mine, even though the, you know, there were a lot of other elements that contributed. For me, it was important for this project to acknowledge that, you know, I'm a white woman, that outsider, a white outsider coming in and collaborating as a collaboration, what that does is it kind of muddies ownership of when things might go wrong. So for me,
interesting.
It was like I'm going to take responsibility and accountability that these photographs are mine.
And so even though the process was collaborative and the journey was collaborative, the idea is that if there was something that didn't go the way you wanted it to go, or alternatively the output, the artworks that you created were in a context that shouldn't be there, you could then be responsible of going, okay, actually I can remove them because they're mine, or I can withhold them or whatever it might be, or, as you say, be accountable for something because you're, as you say, the outsider, the invitee, but also you have the agency to do that then.
Exactly. But that didn't mean that I can't share the benefits.
Totally. Yeah, so, which is lovely. Yeah.
So the way that the project came about was, you know, that the works have been exhibited in galleries, but the main kind of part that I was most happy about was that it was put into a book. So we created
a
book.
And that's the book that's in... actually back in PNG, right? Like they've got,
So the work has returned. The images have returned to Papua New Guinea. But the way that the book was made, it was made and published by a grassroots organisation, the Kainaka Project, where we did the lumen prints. And they designed it. So there's lots and lots of colour, lots and lots of images. So it's not like a typical photo book that we would be like, oh, you know.
That Western lens of, this artifact.
And so it has been, it was created for it to function in that space. So it's been put into schools, back into schools.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's been sold internationally with money then. The community really wanted a water tank, so they've been able to put a water tank in the community where the medicinal plants were, the project was undertaken. And then also they've been given to, the books have been given to another grassroots organisation, Rara Ray Foundation, and they used it for fundraising. So fundraising is really big in Papua New Guinea. So just raising funds for different things, different projects. And so they used the books to sell and raise money to train librarians small local libraries. So, so that for me, that was really interesting in that way of just like relinquishing control about where something's going to be and to see what unfolds and how the project itself can take a life of its own.
But it's also had such an amazing impact then too, like an international impact, a local impact, and they feel, I assume that they, with that project and with the book, that it's not only an acknowledgement of kind of what they have and valuing what they have, but then as an education tool too, which is incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And just the, you know, they've just, it's just positive, you yeah, know, like.
Yeah. Which is so lovely for an art project, yeah. Don't you think? Yes. Like we don't get to always see those things, and also at such a high level in terms of your artistic engagement, the ethics around it, like it really, yeah, I mean, it's such a beautiful project. It really should be celebrated. I think you did an incredible job on that. And the writing, excuse me, and the writing within the PhD thesis was just so engaging and articulate too around your journey through that, I think, yeah.
Thank you.
Moving on to more recent things, I've noticed through a couple of conversations, but also some of the works that have been exhibited in group shows and things, that you have started recently using AI as a prompt tool within some of your new works or in your work in progress. How's that going? And I guess what prompted you to use that? Sorry, terrible pun.
I love it. Yeah, well, through the project in CY, I was working with a chief, and we ended up falling in love. And we had got two little babies. We've got Sakui, who's turning 4 in a month, and we've got little Narang, who's 2. So for the last 4 years has been quite hectic with two little babies.
With beautiful babies. They are
beautiful,
stunning children.
Beautiful babies. Yeah. So I had for quite a while 2 under 2.
Crazy lady.
Life was really hectic.
Yes.
And, you know, like many, you know, women and primary caregivers, kids are first, number one. And totally. So my artwork and my art practice, I had to put aside for a while. I didn't have the space. I didn't
totally.
Have the,
oh my
the
gosh,
physical,
yes.
mental, emotional space to make as well. Probably a couple of years ago, about 18 months ago, I started to get a little bit of space, not much, 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there. And I felt like I wanted to make again. And AI, image generators, were kind of, you know, becoming a bit more known. And so I started playing around with them because it actually fitted into my lifestyle at that time, where I'd have a few minutes here and there between looking after the kids. So I could log on. I'm not saying AI image making is easy, because it's not. It takes a lot of time.
It's very time consuming for someone
that
didn't have any time.
Yes. But what it does, what it enabled me to do was it kind of does, like I was using DALL-E 2 back then, and it archives your history of all your image making. So in many ways it it did a lot of the work that I would have to do if I was doing analog processes. That took it out for me. So I could easily go back.
Yeah, that's really
a week later and continue the work, but know exactly where I was up to.
Yeah, which is quite fascinating, because it is that thing where unless you've got a dedicated studio space, which very few of us do, you have to essentially set up, pack, you know, work on and pack down again. I mean, I did that when Eleanor was a baby in my PhD, like 90 minutes, like create a studio, take some photos, pack down the studio, because then it was where she would play. Like,
absolutely.
And so I think that's really interesting that, as you say, you would have had to spend the same amount of time setting up or preparing for the analog process, but you could actually do it because it enabled you to have that log or that tracking of where you were in the process, and you could just come back to. Amazing.
Yeah, and it was amazing. And you know, my early images were not that great, but you know, I was quite fascinated in the process of it. Like I really I was quite fascinated for a couple of reasons. Fascinated because it was such a, you know, a year, 18 months ago, there was such a backlash against AI image making. And I thought that's really fascinating because it reminded me of when digital came in.
Totally. Or the Polaroid or so many other things.
And so I was like, well, it's in my mind, I was like, it's not going to go anywhere. I want to learn more about it and try and figure out how I can work with it in a way that, you know, makes sense for me and is, you know, harmonious because, yeah, it's not going to go anywhere. So, yeah, so I was just playing around with it. But then I thought, oh, isn't it just really fascinating how it's like a mirror of how we see the world. So the way that the images are scraped from the internet and then they're compiled through the, you know, something's put back to you through the text prompts, but really it's just a mirror of how we've imaged the world.
That's a previously. Really lovely way to put it, I have to say. I think that's not how many people see it. So I think that's a really poetic way of translating that process.
Very absolutely. Cool. Yeah. And, you know, when I talk about it, we, again, it comes back in terms of the ethics is that we may create an image based on what we've mirrored in society and it may not be something that we want to see. As we know, a lot of AI image makers, it can stereotype, it can be discriminatory.
Yep.
But we as the person that has made that image through the text prompts, we have that decision and that power to say, no, I'm not going to show that work. But we need to acknowledge that that mirror that we have of those images that we've used to create that image is a reflection of our society and we've got to do better.
Oh, my gosh, totally. I think that's an amazing thing to say, Kate. Like, that's really powerful. AI as a tool of revealing to us where our gaps are, where the holes are, where we need, as you say, where we need to do better. Like,
yes. So that's that. Like, it came from that. It came from not having much time as a young mum, being fascinated by the backlash and me going, well, what? Let's learn more about it. Like, let's not just have a wall up. Let's just try and understand it a bit better. So yes, I've been working with it and it was an idea that came to me. I was like, oh, just when I was working with it, just having a bit of a play and just thinking, oh, I'd really love to think about what Anna Atkins' seminal work way back in the 1800s, the impressions, cyanotype impressions of algae, what that body of work might look like now with digital technology.
Wow, that's amazing.
So I've been, it's just meant to be a really curious kind of project, a little bit fun, inquisitive, trying to think about the interconnectedness of things.
Yep, and over time.
So living and non-living matter and over time. So I've been making these images through the AI image generators and then changing them into negatives and then making cyanotypes, putting them back into a physical form.
Okay, I didn't realize that part. That's cool. So there is that materiality and process, physical process still, you know, chemical process, I should say.
Yes.
Oh, because they're very beautiful. Like they're really, really stunning, quite emotive, quiet images, which actually speaks back to Anna Atkins, I think, quite beautifully, but also as a way of thinking about the small moments that we can draw from the environment right now, or maybe as a antidote to AI, to the backlash, to the actually we can create something really quiet and beautiful and of the environment.
Absolutely. And it speaks to, for me, it just like, yeah, it speaks to quite a few different things for me. But the main thing is like, you know, digital technology is not going anywhere. AI is not going anywhere. So how do we work with it in a way that is harmonious so that humans, other living matter, the environment, the digital component all can live together in a harmonious way.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I'd love to talk a little bit about how your career has changed, because it's been quite long and very successful. But also, as you say, you know, digital, AI, they're not going away. That's been part of our trajectory and understanding within our photographic career in the landscape. Is there any kind of key moments you want to reflect on or tell us a little bit about?
Look, the PhD project really changed my career quite a bit. So in the sense of it made me think about, I guess, what success is. So probably before that I was very much in the contemporary art scene in
yep.
Melbourne and thinking, so I want to keep exhibiting, getting into the big shows, that's how I define success. And then through this project and then, you know, rethinking what success and what a value is, how value can function in multiple societies and all that, that has really shifted the way that I see my career and where I want it to go, if that makes sense.
Yeah, fantastic. Totally makes sense. It also feels like maybe it's, more authentic to you rather than you feeling like you have to be part of the, hamster wheel.
Yes. And being okay that things can be a little bit smaller and they can be a little bit quieter and we don't have to be things don't have to be so big.
Oh, my gosh, totally. And more sustainable. I think that's something that you get to, well, for me anyway, I've got to midlife and having a child and doing all the things and it's like actually I can't produce a brand new series of work every year. Like it's just not. And, and it can't go into all the shows or all the competition. You know, it just, you have to find ways of making it more doable in the moment.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that for me was just a really great moment in the way that my career's changed. And I'm really interested in how my work might function beyond gallery spaces now. So, and that was, again, I loved just doing that book with the medicinal plants. That was a really fun one. And it wasn't a photo book. Like it was just, and again, it was because I was relinquishing control and just giving away kind of like, my decisions and let other people. And how beautiful was what was created. So
totally.
Those are kind of things that I'm really looking forward to.
And more meaningful too.
More meaningful, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I guess what's on the horizon now, like with two young children and having that mindset of it being okay to be a bit slower or a bit smaller or have more impact and meaning, what are you looking forward to?
So what we'll be doing is taking the children back to Bougainville next year and we'll be spending a month or two there. And I've been in discussions with this community up in the Kunua region, which is up in the mountains. And they have this wonderful conservation project up there where they, it's a grassroots organization, do incredible work looking after their environment. And they have a tree planting project that they're doing where they're revitalizing parts of their rainforest by planting native plants.
Okay.
So it's this really, really beautiful project that it's all community driven. And I'm going to go there and make some anthotypes from the actual
native plants.
Yeah. The native plants.
Wow.
So it came about because I actually when my husband, Jeff, and I got together, I ended up living up in PNG for three to four years. And my husband is into environmental conservation with his community that he lives with. And so I was always helping on just on around the sides. And, you know, I saw the struggle that they had trying to get funding, like external funding. Yeah. Not trouble. There was always money there, but all the stipulations.
Oh, I see. Okay.
From overseas external funding. People.
Yeah.
External people and how it just really caused a lot of disharmony in the communities.
Yeah.
So it was really sad. And anyway, I think, you know, this project that I'm doing with the Kunua people, it's just a celebration that, you know, they've been doing it right way longer than any of us, and we're still trying to control.
and
we just need to celebrate.
Yeah,
that people have been doing it for forever, you know, and they just at that grassroots level, you know, just it's just a beautiful, beautiful project of, you know, people looking after their environment.
Yeah, wow, and meeting their environment on equal ground rather than being, as you say before, extractive or dominating or reshaping. It's actually meeting their environment in a really beautiful and harmonious way. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And how wonderful that you can be part of that project. That's really, really cool.
I know. I'm very, very lucky. I feel very fortunate. So it'll be really lovely because the children will come up with us into the community as well. So it's, you know, it's
all the things
culture,
like,
so
yeah, I was gonna say, like, and I feel like that's a really beautiful note to end on, because it does feel like you're being really authentically yourselves and true to your culture and your marriage and parenthood and all the things, but also your art practice as being part of that circular process. It's not something sitting outside. It's something totally central to who you are and your family, which is so inspiring. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think that's the really lovely way of putting it. Like, it's, again, just like finding how it all sits together in a way that feels
totally
authentic and right.
Out of the Frame is produced by Pia Johnson, music by Steph O'Hara, and graphic design by Brent Leadovitz.